I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Don't believe the hype. There is nothing glamorous about being a sleep-deprived, stressed-out mother. Jason Reitman's new movie, Tully, starring Charlize Theron, is about Marlo, a mother of three, including a brand new baby. She's trying to take care of her family without falling apart. Her brother suggests a night nanny so she can get some rest, and in walks Tully, who not only takes care of the infant, she cleans the house and she makes cupcakes. Here's Marlo talking with Tully, played by Mackenzie Davis.
You seem like a great mom.
Great moms organize class parties and casino night. They bake cupcakes that look like minions. All the things I'm just too tired to do. Honestly, even getting dressed just feels exhausting. I open my closet and I just think, didn't I just do this?
Yeah, but that's the downside of living on a planet with a short solar day. Although Jupiter's even shorter.
You're like a book of fun facts for unpopular fourth graders.
Film explores this dream come true relationship and what it reveals about Marlo's married life. This is the third time that Jason Reitman has teamed up with screenwriter Diablo Cody. Their other collaborations are Juno and Young Adult, which also starred Charlize Theron. Reitman's first feature film was Thank You for Smoking. We have queued up a number of his films, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about Tully, what he looks for in a film, in a performance, in dialogue. Jason Reitman, it's been 10 years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So what do you know about motherhood?
I'm a father, so clearly nothing. I think as a dad, I belong to the group that is willing to do 5% of the work and take 100% of the credit.
Well, there is a father like that in this film. Mm-hmm. He's a nice guy, but he's a bit checked out, a bit clueless.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember when I read the script for Tully for the first time, and I said to Diablo, I said, God, this father's really not present. I'm worried people will hate him. And Diablo said, no, I think he's a pretty good representation of the fathers. I think people are going to look on screen and recognize that dad.
He's played by Ron Livingston.
Yeah, and that's frankly one of the tricky things about casting that role is you do want to like that guy, and he is trying, even though he's not doing enough. And we had to portray a marriage that had gone quiet, and we need an actor in that role who is still likable. And Ron Livingston is a guy who you just can't help but love him. Mm-hmm. All our associations with him, if you walk down the street with him, you just kind of see people smile at him.
Really?
Yeah.
You've seen that happen?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And it's funny, I've been making movies for about 10 years now, and you get different relationships with different actors, and you see how the public reacts to them, because if you walk down the sidewalk with them, I just see the moment where all the eyes realize who they are, and you get that immediate glance of, oh, this is their relationship with them. And my favorite was, strangely, and this is not someone I've worked with, but I know, is Fred Savage. And Fred Savage, who was on The Wonder Years when he was younger. And people only have a positive relationship with – they light up. There's a different kind of smile when they see Fred Savage.
That's fascinating. This is your third film with Diablo Cody. Was this your idea, her idea? How did you collaborate on Tully?
I mean,
Tully?
Any marriage, you don't know on the first date that this is someone –
is that how you think of it?
Yeah. And you don't know this is going to be someone that you're going to spend your life with. And we met 12 years ago or so when I read that Juno screenplay. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with that script. But what has happened now is each 5 years she's written a script that, we're about the same age, and she writes a script that speaks to what both of us are feeling at the given time.
And so she's a mom?
Yeah, she's a mother of three.
A mother of three. So this is autobiographical to some degree?
I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, look, I think to a certain extent all films are autobiographical, not the plots, but what is underneath them. And certainly with Diablo, she is writing from experience, and that's how – I think that's the reason she writes the way she writes. I got a phone call from Diablo, and she described Tully in two sentences, and I said, you have to write that. And then 6 weeks later, there was a screenplay.
No.
I mean,
is that how she works?
It's infuriating, frankly, because it took me 7 years to write Up in the Air. But she writes purely. There's no treatment. There's no index cards. She walks into the woods and comes out the other side.
What were those two sentences that she wrote?
I don't want to give away the movie, but she basically described a movie in which a mother with three children is going through postpartum and described the kind of moment when we become a parent and we start to think of our younger self as a different human being. And while Juno was about growing up too fast and Young Adult was growing up a little too slow, this is a movie about that moment when you start to feel that separation with your younger self.
There are a number of scenes, I think any parent, and I would certainly include mothers and fathers in this, where you just the sort of repetitiveness of burping the baby, changing the diapers, burping the baby, feeding the baby, trying to catch a cat nap.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky, right? Because there's so many movies that try to portray the doldrums of parenthood, and you have, you know, moments where there's always a parent who picks up their child and the child pees on them, and it's just kind of a soft joke. And we really wanted to portray parenthood in a way that you recognize on screen. And the most honest version is one where you're scared. You know, you're in the middle of the night, and you don't know if you're doing the right thing. You don't know if you're failing your child. And you feel alone.
Well, you cast Charlize Theron to play Marlo, this, you know, sleep-deprived mother. And as a complete outsider, I mean, I think of her as an extremely glamorous and beautiful woman. Why did you want to
You've never had drinks with her, clearly.
Well, no, believe me, I haven't. But help us understand this casting.
Well, you know, the first time I met her, we were oddly at the Oscars, and she pulled me aside and we started talking. She almost immediately told me a very dark joke, and I was struck. I was like, oh, you're one of us. And I just kind of fell in love with her right there and then, and knew I wanted to make movies with her. And I really credit Diablo to be able to write the kind of roles that, you know, give Charlize a chance to show her sense of humor.
She gained 50 pounds. I don't know. Is that a big deal? Is that something that she – I mean, it would be a big deal for most people. But for a role, was that your idea, her idea?
I wish I could say there was a moment in which we said, all right, clearly you're going to have to do this. I think she automatically – she just started eating. She knew that this is how she would have to be portrayed. I mean, I have joked that the real Daniel Day-Lewis move would have been to get pregnant for the first act of the film where she's, you know, at 9 months. But she started sending me these photos of her, you know, eating cheeseburgers and drinking milkshakes, and I would Photoshop them to say "j'adore" on them and email them back to her. She wants to feel it.
Right.
I don't think it's as much about prosthetics or no prosthetics. There's certain actors who are puppeteers, and they're just kind of moving their body around, and that actually can work very well. But there's other actors who want to feel it, and that's who she is. So by gaining the weight, by having that disassociation with her own body, even the messing with her own brain chemistry by putting all that crap and sugar in her system, I think she feeds off that.
Well, and it's so interesting. I think anyone who has been pregnant, that body, I mean, she's carrying around this giant pregnant belly and then obviously has the baby, but then she's got all this weight that's just feels like, in many ways, like a burden.
Well, and it again, if the concept of this movie is about being estranged from yourself, all that leads to it. I mean, when you start putting all that weight, your shoe size changes. You know, you start feeling back pain for reasons that you didn't know. All these other things start to happen, and that means while we're shooting, she's feeling these things, and they start to come out of her performance.
Marlo has a very wealthy brother. He's the one who suggests this night nanny, and I love the fact that their nanny has a master's degree and is named Shanta.
Yeah.
I really wanted to
Shasta,
hate them.
Think, yeah.
Or Shasta, maybe it is. Shasta, yes.
Yeah, and I have to credit, you know, Mark Duplass, who's an amazing director, an amazing actor, and I kind of remember the moment where I saw the puffy chair and started falling in love with the films of the Duplass brothers and immediately wanted to work with them. And I got to produce one of their films, Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Oh.
But Mark has one of the hardest jobs in this movie. In every movie, there's a person who at one point has to kind of give the plot of the movie and tell you why you're there. And it's a thankless gig as an actor to be, you know, in a science fiction film, you'd be the scientist who goes, well, you know, this asteroid showed up and now these aliens are here. And so Mark has to do that, but he's such a good actor and he's so funny that he finds a way to make it naturalistic and it makes us all look better.
And it made me think of Mary Poppins, who, you know, sort of comes in with her umbrella and lands in this family and cleans everything up.
There's absolutely a Mary Poppins element to this movie. It's an adult Mary Poppins, and that is why Tully shows up wearing a large blue overcoat, and there's a brooch on her lapel that is a nod to the brooch on Mary Poppins' hat.
Was that your idea?
It was a combination of ideas.
And you cast Mackenzie Davis for this role.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, I'm not questioning why, but
I mean, if you want to get into it, we can argue.
No. I thought she was terrific.
She's remarkable, and she adds that piece of magic. You know, there's something about her eyes. Her eyes have endless curiosity and intelligence, and we needed someone who could walk into this home and be curious about a woman who feels that no one is curious about her. This is something we talked about a lot. Again, this moment in the middle of the night where you feel alone as a parent, mm-hmm. and you're scared, and who would you want to show up to save you?
Part of me felt like, uh-oh, this is going to end really badly. I mean, this, you know, too good to be true nanny has arrived, and all hell is going to break loose.
Well, as a filmmaker, that makes me feel good. I mean, it's funny. As a director, it's a weird job because sometimes you're trying to make people laugh, but then sometimes you're given the audience to take care of, but then sometimes you have to scare them and sometimes you have to hurt them. And in order to get to the other end, you certainly need to threaten them. And it doesn't feel good as a director to do that. In a strange way that as a parent sometimes you don't enjoy scolding your children, but it's part of the job, I guess.
And I guess giving the film over to the audience and they're going to have their own reaction to what you've done.
Well, that's the part of directing that I love the most, is I don't like films that tell me what to think, and I've always strived to make films that leave the argument for the car on the way home.
You have two kids in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something special about casting kids or what you wanted to look for in these young actors?
I think
who didn't look like young actors to me, I have to say.
Right. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that you need to find young actors who just are the roles themselves, that you're not going to find, you know, a five-year-old who's a method actor. You know, they just have to kind of be themselves, and they have to have a strong interior life. You need to find a kid whose mind is in the clouds and is thinking about things and creating things in their brain, and you need those things to come off on camera. And I was very lucky that Asher and Leah both wanted to share that with us. And Asher in particular, his parents are actors, and they would talk about each morning. It's like what he's doing each day so he could feel it, you know, in those scenes.
And he's, again, without giving too much away, he's a kid. He's an outside-the-box kid. I think that's the description of him.
Yeah. And I think, again, as a parent, we always feel this, like we're having a conversation with a professional about our child and they're telling us about our child. And whether you have a child that is on the spectrum or not on the spectrum, all these different adjectives start getting thrown out. And there's this idea that we are supposed to diagnose our children and rather than just raise them and let them tell us who they are. And one of these themes in the movie is Marlo as a mother trying to feel decent about the job she's doing and kind of is given forgiveness from each of the people in her life, including her five-year-old son.
We'll just take a very short break and get back to our conversation talking with Jason Reitman. He's got a new film. It's called Tully. It stars Charlize Theron. We've been talking about it. He's got other films as well. And as I said, we've got some clips queued up. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with film director Jason Reitman. Again, his new film, Tully, it opens this Friday in the Philadelphia area. It's about a sleep-deprived mother and a too-good-to-be-true nanny. What do you look for in an actor? Are there certain things that you look for?
It's a great question. It's a very tricky one to answer in that. I think it's like, what do you look for in someone that you're dating? I mean, it's such a kind of an unknowable thing, and you just kind of feel it when you see it. But truth. I mean, that's the job at the end of the day. My dad called me. My father's a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And before my first film,
Reitman.
He gave me a ring and said, look, remember, your job is not to make things funny. Don't worry about that. Your job is to find truth. And so when you're shooting, don't ask yourself if this is funny, because your barometer for comedy will never be as good as your barometer for honesty. That's what he said. So I think that's what I look for the most. And truth doesn't mean to be telling truth. Truth just, can you bring truth to the situation, whether you're in a movie that takes place on Mars or one that takes place in a house like Tully? You need to be an actor that finds truth in what you're doing.
I think for outsiders – acting, we think of acting as pretending.
Right.
But it's not. I mean, acting is in a sense, not acting.
Yeah, exactly. Acting is strangely the opposite. And what makes Charlize remarkable is that she feels what her characters feel. And that's kind of the scary thing about working with her is you can see her reaching for it all the time. She wants to feel it so badly. And if they hurt, she wants to hurt. And at a certain, you know, there's certain actors you need to push, but then there's other actors you need to protect.
And what do you like on the set? Are you a hands-on director? Are you leeway do you give your actors?
I'm a very specific director, and actors have a very funny way of referring to that. If you ask an actor about a specific director like myself, they'll say, oh, he really knows what he wants.
Are you a do this, do that kind of actor?
Director, rather? You know, look, I mean, I think when it comes to the camera side of things, I'm very specific. A month in advance of shooting, I go to the location with stand-ins and a still camera, and I take a photo of every shot we're going to do. Mm-hmm. We mark down the lens, and we create a packet of all those photo boards that all the key people on the film get. So when they arrive at a location, they know exactly what we're going to shoot, where the actor's going to be, where they're going to go. And to that extent, it's very specific. Mm. But with my cast, I try to cast actors who I trust. And I don't rehearse ever. And I don't give direction before the first take because,
really?
Yeah, as soon as you direct someone, you lose their instinct. And I'm casting them because of their instincts. And I know that on take two or take five or take 10, I can direct them to wherever I want to direct them. But the interesting thing is to see what magic comes out first.
So it's a kind of a storyboard that you've created, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe more than that?
I can't draw, so I never draw them. So I do photo boards to make up for my lack of skill sets. And then once we get there, there's a framework within the act where the actors can work within, and they know what their walls are, but within those walls they can do what they want.
We're going to play some clips, but having listened to a bunch of them over the weekend, I mean, you really like dialogue. Dialogue seems so important to you as a director.
Yeah, I think I'm a verbal person in life. I love talking to people, and I think there's probably nothing I enjoy more.
And something about Diablo Cody's dialogue, which I have to say feels natural, spoken by really smart people.
Yeah, it's very hard dialogue to actually read.
Is it?
Well, because, look, she uses very unique turns of phrase, and there's kind of a hidden truth behind everything she writes. There's always surprise, and there's always some unknowing thing about the characters that you find out by the end. And oddly, and I don't know why this is, I've cast a lot of non-Americans to do her words, and I don't know why Ellen Page and Michael Cera and Mackenzie Davis and Charlize Theron, none of them Americans, have a natural way around the dialogue. And I'm not sure it's because they grew up somewhere else and they bring something else to the table, but their mouths find a way around her words.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've only kind of realized it recently, but there's a consistency. It may be an accident, but.
Well, let me play. This is really your first feature film. This is Thank You for Smoking, mm-hmm. which you both directed and you also wrote the screenplay.
So, yeah, I adapted it from the Christopher Buckley novel.
Exactly. So we'll hear some of your dialogue. Aaron Eckhart plays a tobacco lobbyist. He's having a drink with an alcohol industry spokeswoman, played by Maria Bello, and a gun lobbyist, played by David, is it Keschner?
Keckner.
Let's give it a listen and we'll talk about it.
Who's paying for it? He says the tobacco company's paying for it. I said, I don't need a bodyguard. I'm a man of the people.
Rock on, Kennedy.
Listen, we're all going to need bodyguards soon enough. Did you see the coverage of the fetal alcohol people got themselves over this weekend? They made it seem like we were encouraging pregnant women to drink. I'm surprised I didn't get kidnapped on my way to work this morning.
I don't think people from the alcoholic beverage industry need to worry about being kidnapped just yet.
Pardon me?
Look, I mean, nothing personal, but tobacco generates a little more heat than alcohol.
Oh, this is news.
Well, my product puts away 475,000 a year.
Oh, okay, now 475 is a legit number.
Okay, 435,000, that's 1,200 a day. How many alcohol-related deaths a year?
Well,
100,000 tops? Well, that's what, 270 a day? Wowee. 270 people, the tragedy. Excuse me if I don't exactly see terrorists getting excited about kidnapping anyone from the alcohol industry.
Well, you haven't even taken into account the number of deaths
a year. Bobby, how many gun deaths a year in the U.S.?
11,000?
11,000. Are you kidding me? 30 a day? It's less than passenger car mortalities. No terrorists would bother with either of you. Get the stupid argument.
I'll say.
I'm sure both of you warrant vigilante justice.
Thank you.
That is so great. That is satire, folks. And I love the fact that we've got these lobbyists competing. I guess who's the best worst lobbyist, right?
I mean, remember when the scariest thing were cigarettes and booze?
Yes, I do. Exactly. And this was how many? 2005.
Yeah. And I do not deserve credit for that writing. That's all from the book. That's all from the book by Christopher Buckley, which was a really important book for me. When I was trying to find my voice as a filmmaker, I read that book and went, oh, this is who I am. This is who I want to be.
In what way?
You know, it had a sense of humor that I'd never read before. There was something about the way it just kind of stared into death and had a sense of humor about it, and comedy had always been important to me, but it spoke to politics in an interesting way. It spoke to human behavior in an interesting way, and I just found my voice while writing it.
And it seems very current, if I can say.
Strangely,
I mean, so.
Yeah, indeed. Well, particularly in that we should all have a better sense of humor. And we've lost it. And I know if you go on Twitter, there's a lot of comedy on there. But I don't know. I'm not sure if this makes sense. It feels like there's a lot of comedy on there's a lot of comedy on Twitter, but I'm not sure if anyone has a sense of humor about it.
Oh, I find Twitter a very unnerving place.
It's a scary neighborhood. Yeah, it's the other side of the tracks.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jason Reitman, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new film called Tully. It stars Charlize Theron, about a very sleep-deprived mother and a night nanny who comes to help. Our guest has also done other films as well, including Juno and Up in the Air, and we're going to play some clips from that as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can just listen as we talk. Your dad, Ivan Reitman, the director of Ghostbusters and Animal House and other comedies.
Yeah.
I read that, in a sense, you grew up in edit rooms and on sound stages, and really as a kid or as a baby even, this was your world.
I think I was 11 days old on the set of Animal House.
Is that right?
Yeah, profound effect. there's nowhere else I've ever wanted to be more than on set or in a movie theater.
Really?
And yeah, I mean, it's just, look, being on set feels like being part of the circus. And as a young person, it's really exciting. You know, the trucks show up. They show up at a new location that no one's ever shot at normally before. And they open the trucks and all this equipment comes out. And they put on a little play for camera. And then at the end of the day, they close up the trucks. They go somewhere new. And as a young person, it's an absolute thrill.
Yeah. I mean, that is very circus-like. Yeah. And then moves on essentially to the next town.
And the people on that crew, and, you know, as the 5-year-old or 10-year-old or 15-year-old, I would kind of travel around with them and experience what they are experiencing. That for 3 months, you get to know these people better than anyone in your life. You see them more than your family and your loved ones, and you're on the road together as well. And then at the end of it, there's this kind of heartbreaking goodbye, and everyone joins another circus.
And your mom's an actor, right?
Well, she was an actor before I was born, and she directed a movie when I was younger. But I primarily know her as my mom.
And you've been acted in some movies as well.
I think
God. Of your parents were, yes, God.
My father, as a cosmic joke, took me at my worst moments of my puberty and put him on screen.
That is heartless.
And in fact, my first kiss was in one of his films.
Oh, dear.
My father directed my first kiss.
And what film was that?
That was in
Kindergarten. So we can check it out.
Kindergarten Cop.
And what was it like, I mean, to see your dad sort of orchestrating this circus, this performance?
You know, normal. In the same way that as a kid, anything your parents do seems normal. I mean, no matter whether your parents raise you well or poorly, you only find out as an adult, wait a second, they were doing that? Whether they were allowing you to ride without the seatbelt or, you know, whether, you know, if you had, you know, tooth pain as a kid, they rubbed, you know, whiskey on your gums. I mean, things that you're like, wait a second, what were you thinking? And not that my parents did either of those things. Watching my father on set was strangely normal. And by the time I got to set, I think one of the great advantages I had was a movie set felt like a normal place to me.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of filmmakers have to go through the hurdles of feeling comfortable being in charge of 100 people and all this equipment, and there's money being spent, and, you know, time is not on your side. And that was already a very natural place for me to exist.
I read, ran across, I guess it was an interview that you and your dad did at the Toronto International Film Festival talking about Ghostbusters. You said, I would make the most boring Ghostbusters of all time. It would be people talking about ghosts.
Yeah, there wouldn't be much busting going on. My father and I are very different filmmakers. I've always said that my father wants to take your favorite song and play it better than you've ever heard. I want to take your least favorite song and somehow play it good enough that you'll like it.
Oh, fascinating. Does he see it that way too?
He sees the truth in that. I mean, we have a different relationship with the audience, but I think that's because of where we come from. I mean, my father is a baby boomer whose parents are Holocaust survivors who had to escape at one point by his family hiding under the floorboards of a boat and arriving in Canada with nothing, and my grandfather managing a dry cleaner and then a car wash. And so, of course, my father wants to make movies that just make people happy. You know, there was a moment when he was a kid and they were hiding on a farm and with only French people, and he had to put on little puppet shows to communicate because he didn't speak French. So, yes, he makes movies where you go see it and you just feel better about yourself walking out. He wants to do that. I could not have had a more fortunate upbringing. I grew up in Beverly Hills, of course, and that comes with privilege and arrogance. And of course, I want to make, you know, tough movies that give the audience a slightly more arduous experience. I still want to make people laugh. I do want people to come out of the movies feeling less alone. But I'm lucky that I get to make these movies.
It seems, too, your parents are together. I don't know how much of an anomaly that is in Hollywood to have a marriage that lasts a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think you've been in rehab. I mean, it seems like you seem to have survived Hollywood.
My parents are just decent people, and they were present, which, you know, I think that's the most important part of it. And they've been married a long time. I just had dinner with my dad the day. I said, God, you and Mom have been married almost 40 years now? And my dad goes, over 40, you're 40.
Do the math. Right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There was a time you were considering medical school, too.
Oh, yeah, for a brief
moment.
Well, look, I mean, I'm well aware of how people think of the children of famous people or famous directors. And if you're the son of a famous director, most likely you do have a drug alcohol problem. You are probably a talentless, you know, pain in the ass jerk. And I at first I thought, why enter a profession where that was the presumption of me going in? Mm. And I thought, I'll become a doctor. No one ever asks a doctor, why do you want to become a doctor? And it was while I was pre-med, my father came to visit me and said, you know, what are you doing?
Really?
Yeah.
I mean that directly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know the restaurant it happened in. And I said, I'm scared. And he said, well, scared's not a reason to do anything. And he told me a story from him being a kid growing up in Toronto. And at one point, there was this successful sandwich chain in Montreal, and my father had wanted to open up a branch in Toronto and told my grandfather, help me put this together. Give me some money to start one of these sandwich shops. And my grandfather said, I'm sure these sandwiches would be very good and you'd raise a lot of money, but there's no magic in it. You need to find something with magic in it. And my father gave me the same advice. He said, you need to find something with magic in it. And in that moment, became the first Jewish father in history to tell his son, don't become a doctor, go become a film director.
But it's interesting that your grandfather, who had survived the Holocaust, was able to see something in his own son.
It's
and
remarkable.
Wanted happiness for him.
Yeah, my father went to college on a music scholarship. The idea that my grandfather was not only okay with this, but was pushing this, it speaks to something so remarkable about him. And, you know, I only knew him as a kid. And I, of course, like any of us, the real conversation is one I'd like to have now as an adult with him.
Sure. How old do you have children?
I have an 11-year-old daughter.
Oh, right. Yeah. So it's coming, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. It's coming too quickly.
Did you do comedy? I read about an improv comedus.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that you brought me on just to humiliate me.
I just know the name, and yeah. I like Latin, so, you know, it works.
I was in an improv troupe in college, yeah. But I was horrible at improv because I think I'm a writer at heart, so in improv, you're supposed to just be working off your instincts, and all I was doing was writing lines of dialogue in my head and trying to force others to enter the scene that I was writing in my head.
That's kind of breaking the rule of improv.
It's 100% anti-improv.
What was your first film then? Before Thank You for Smoking?
I made a short film when I was in college. I made a short comedy about kidney stealing. And I was really, you know, I grew up watching broad comedies and just being a big movie fan and seeing everything that was in the theater. And then there was this moment in the 90s when all these films started coming out of Sundance and other film festivals. It was the moment where, you know, we met Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson and Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze. All these filmmakers emerged almost like rock stars. And that was the moment where I want to do that.
Oh.
And if you looked at my first short films, you would say, oh, I get it. You want to be Quentin Tarantino. It's pretty obvious. And slowly, I think I had to stop. Like, I think anyone who ever tries to create something, at first you emulate the people you admire, and after a while you learn to trust your own voice.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We've got some more clips as well, talking with filmmaker Jason Reitman. Again, he's got a new movie. It's called Tully, starring Charlize Theron, and we've been playing some clips. Thank You for Smoking, his first feature film. We've got Juno queued up. We'll be talking about that as well. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jason Reitman about making movies, and he has made a number of them, including a brand new one called Tully. Also did Juno and Young Adult. Those were written by screenwriter Diablo Cody. And Charlize Theron has been in two of our guest movies as well. First feature film called Thank You for Smoking. Let me play a clip from Juno. But before we do that, this was your first collaboration with Diablo Cody. Can you just set up the quick little premise of what this film is about, and then I'll play the clip?
Certainly. I mean, you know, at its face, Juno is a movie about teenage pregnancy. And certainly when the script showed up, they said, here's a script about teenage pregnancy. And then you come to realize it's really about everything else. It's a movie about growing up too quickly, and a 30-year-old guy who's not growing up at all, and a woman who won't feel like a grown-up until she has a child. And I think that's kind of at the heart of all the films that Diablo and I make together, this kind of overarching theme of never feeling comfortable on your own timeline, always feeling like somehow you're too soon or you're too late or you didn't find the on-ramp to whatever you're supposed to be doing.
And does that feel true for you today after these three films?
I mean, I think everyone feels that to a certain extent, right? And for whatever reason, Diablo and I, that is what we connect on. And when her scripts arrive, I know exactly what she's saying.
Oh, interesting. Well, this came out in 2007. It's a comedy, Juno, directed by our guest, written by Diablo Cody. Ellen Page plays Juno. She's a pregnant teenage girl. Mm-hmm. Michael Cera as her classmate, Polly. Let's listen.
Hey, did you put like 100 things of Tic Tacs in my mailbox?
Oh, yeah, that was me.
Why?
Well, you know, they're your fave. And, I mean, you can never have too many of your favorite one-calorie breath mints, so I just thought I'd...
Yeah, well, thanks. I think I'm pretty much set until college on the Tic Tac front.
You know, Bleak, I was thinking, and I'm sorry I was such a huge bitch to you. You don't deserve it.
It's okay, you know. It's okay.
And also, I think I'm in love with you.
You can meet as friends?
No. I mean, for real, because you're like the coolest person I've ever met, and you don't even have to try, you know?
I try really hard, actually.
You're, like, naturally smart. You're not like everyone else. You don't stare at my stomach all the time. You look at my face, and every time I see you, the baby starts kicking super hard.
It does? Lizard.
I think it's because my heart starts pounding every time I see you.
Mine too.
That's all I could ask for. Golden.
Can we make out now?
It's really a lovely scene. I mean, I got teary-eyed listening to that.
I actually did too, which is an embarrassing thing to admit. But it is for me also like opening up a 10-year-old photo book and going back through the memories. What's remarkable to me is that that is the first script that Diablo ever wrote.
Yeah.
You know, she went to a store and picked up one of those published screenplays. I think it was for the movie Ghost World, and read it. And only by reading a published screenplay realized, okay, so first you put interior, exterior, and you say the location name, and then you put the name of the character in the middle of the page, and you put dialogue underneath it. And she read one script, figured out how to do it, and then sat down, and without plotting out where she was going to go, wrote the first scene, then wrote the second scene, then wrote the third scene. And the result was this remarkable screenplay that, you know... Everyone who read it at the time knew that it was special. I'm just a lucky guy. I didn't even get hired at first to direct the movie.
Oh, who
did? They hired. I'm not gonna out them because, but I didn't get the job at first, and they went down the road with another director, and that was a heartbreaker. I mean, that was a script that got away, and then when that director parted ways, Thank You for Smoking had just come out. And I was riding a little heat because my movie was doing well, and I was one of four directors who then went up for the script again, and this time I got it.
Wow. Did you have to do any rewriting, or did it come pretty much
tailor-made? Scripts come in ready to shoot. I think we added one scene, which was an important scene, which is the scene where Jen Garner feels the baby kick for the first time. And even after we shot, we added one little moment of Juno on the side of the road, having just returned from Jen Garner and Jason Bateman's house when she makes the decision that she's going to give the baby to Jen Garner. Yeah. And she writes a note to her on the back of her receipt. And we added that late in the day.
I mean, you make movies, not all of them, but about women and about being a mom and being pregnant. Do you know why?
I mean, God, it's a great question. There was no plan. You know, when I was 16, I moved out of my parents' house and moved in with my girlfriend, who was 26 at the time. And we were together for 7 years. And I have to presume that that was part of it, that I just kind of had an early fascination. And I had a complicated woman in my life when I was a teenager. And I've always surrounded myself with smart, funny women, and I love their stories. And you know, if you want to tell an original story, tell a story about women. I mean, those are stories that have not been told.
More interesting than stories about men?
I don't know.
Or men have had so many stories told about them already.
Yeah, men have had enough stories, and I prefer spending time with women. I guess I find them more interesting, more complicated, And when it comes to comedy, I prefer spending time with funny women.
16 is pretty young to move out of the house.
I mean, trust me.
I mean, you must have been head over heels in love with this woman.
As now being 40 and having an 11-year-old daughter, I think 16 is really young to move out of the house with an older woman. But at the time, I was young and wanted to be taken seriously, and she took me seriously.
Oh, fascinating. Are you still friends?
No.
No. Those are, as I say, complicated.
Young breakups are hard breakups.
They are. They are. I ran across this. This is 5 years old. It's in The Guardian, where you said, I'm trying to figure myself out through my movies, whether it's big stuff like What We're Doing Here or little stuff like Why Aren't I Happier? With every film, I feel like I'm apologizing for something. I feel I'm most successful when I'm looking for something that embarrasses me about my character that I'd like to expose.
That guy sounds pretentious.
And then you go on from there.
Oh, no.
I can, but does that fit now 5 years later?
I mean, I think it's true. I think every film is autobiographical to a certain extent, and everyone is trying to figure themselves out. I mean, that's what our interior life is, right? And I get this chance to do it through my films.
Well, I love movies. I mean, I just love going to the movies, and I love the experience of being in the theater when it gets dark. And, you know, even after decades of going to the movies, it's still one of my most favorite things to do.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because and I love hearing you say that. Too often now, when people are making the argument about why to go to the movies, it has to do with screen size and sound systems. And I don't believe in any of that. People have great screens and sound systems at home. The importance is what happens when you experience emotions you didn't plan on experiencing with strangers. And it's like that moment of being in a concert when a song comes on and you hear it in a different way for the first time. And it's not just you hearing it. You were experiencing it through everyone around you. And what does it mean to laugh with strangers? What does it mean to cry with strangers? And that's why I love going to the movies.
When our son was really little, he said to me, Mom, why don't we go to church? And I said, without thinking, I just said, we go to the movies instead.
Ah, that's an amazing answer.
I mean, I didn't think about it, but that is how I feel about film.
I am going to remember that. And
you can borrow it.
Oh, that's so good.
Tweet from Chelsea. When Juno came out, I was a junior in high school deciding on college plans. I went to see it with friends not knowing anything about it, and I left changed. It is one of the films responsible for my decision to go to film school and still one of my favorites.
Well, I hope the film school decision turned out to be the right thing. I hope she found magic in it like my grandfather would have wanted her to. It's a strange thing to go into a movie thinking, I'm going to make a tiny little movie about teenage pregnancy. It will play some film festivals. And then it connects with people. And I'm well aware right now that the first line of my obituary will either be director of Juno or son of director of Ghostbusters. But you don't know when you're making something special. And that's a remarkable tweet to hear about. That's something that I made, not knowing this human being has connected with her.
Yeah. Let me play another clip from one of your films. This is Up in the Air. You co-wrote the screenplay, and it's George Clooney plays this character named Ryan, and his job is basically to fire people. He travels all over the country, or maybe perhaps even the world, firing people, and he has just met a woman named Alex, played by Vera, is it Farmiga?
Farmiga, yeah.
Farmiga. And they discover they both have a mutual appreciation for the perks of frequent travel and elite status.
Oh, Maplewood card. How dare you bring that into this palace?
Hilton offers equal value and better food, but the Maplewood gives out warm cookies at check-in.
What they got to do with the cookies? Yeah,
I'm a sucker for simulated hospitality.
Yeah, there's an industry term for that. It's a mixture of faux and homey. Foamy.
Oh, my God. I wasn't sure these actually existed. This is the American Airlines...
Yeah, it's a concierge key, yeah.
What is that? Carbon fiber?
Graphite.
Oh, God, I love the weight.
I was pretty excited the day that bad boy came in.
Yeah, I'll say. I put up pretty pedestrian numbers, like 60 thou a year domestic.
It's not bad.
Don't patronize me. What's your total?
That's a personal question.
Oh, please.
Well, we hardly know each other.
Oh, come on, show some hubris. Come on, impress me. I bet it's huge.
You have no idea.
Ah, how big? What is it, this big? This big?
I don't want to brag.
Oh, come on. Come on.
Let's just say I have a number in mind. I haven't hit it yet.
Flirting over frequent flyer miles. That was a really terrific film. I mean, it had this dark edge, and you did include real-life people. This was right during the financial implosion, so people were being either fired or losing their jobs left and right. And you included real people in this film.
Yeah, it was 2010, and we were actually shooting in Detroit and St. Louis, which were, I think were at the time the two cities that got hit hardest by the recession then. And this was the first film that I actually made with my father. He was a producer on the film. And I remember he said, look, I think your script's really working. I think the romantic chemistry between the characters on the page, that is there. But you really need to look at what's happening in this country right now, because you need to get that right. People are going to look on screen and they're going to know if it's wrong. And And it was out of that conversation that we came up with the idea of, well, he needs to fire a lot of people in this movie. And those scenes are probably the most inaccurately written scenes right now. And we put an ad out in the paper and said, we're making a documentary about job loss. We're looking for people in Detroit and St. Louis who are willing to share their stories. And people came in under that ruse. And then we explained to them, we're making a movie. And they would sit down, not with George, because I thought, if you sit people down with George Clooney, then they're just going to want to ask him questions. But we sat them down with a producer who interviewed them, basically, and asked them, where did you work? How did you lose your job? What did they tell you? How has your life changed? And then we'd tell them, we want to do a little bit of a role play. We have this HR document that's a kind of traditional firing document. We're going to read it to you, and then you can respond any way you want. You can respond the way you did the day you lost your job, or you can respond how you wish you had responded. And this remarkable thing happened. All these non-actors used sense memory even though they didn't know they were doing it. And they started to say the kinds of things I could never write. And they brought truth to the film.
And instead of, I guess, taking their lines, you just let them – I mean, they're in the film.
Oh, yeah. And they're now actually members of SAG and get benefits. So.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Let me squeeze one more film in. And this is Young Adult, a 2011 movie that you made. And again, Charlize Theron plays this young adult, an author. I guess she's a ghostwriter named Mavis.
Yeah.
She's talking with her parents at her home. She basically goes home where she had been the beauty queen and wants to, I guess, get back an old boyfriend.
Yeah.
Let's give it a listen.
Hey, well, Mom, can you please take down that photo of me and Alan?
Which picture, sweetie?
The wedding photo? We are divorced.
We just thought it was a nice memory.
Of my failed marriage?
Well, the wedding wasn't a failure. Remember the tiramisu?
I like that, Alan.
Dad, he's my ex-husband. You're supposed to be on my team.
He's a nice guy, that's all. I didn't know there were teams.
Have you seen any old friends on this visit?
Actually, I've been seeing quite a bit of Buddy.
Oh, the old beau, huh?
I remember you kids were so cute in high school.
It's funny how those initial instincts can be so right, you know? I mean, you make all these mistakes along the way, but the world will make sure you end up with the person you're meant to be with.
It's good to keep those people in your life. The people who really know you best.
Mm-hmm.
And that new baby of his is just darling.
Have you seen it? Up close?
Written by Diablo Cody. Are you and Diablo Cody going to keep collaborating as far as you can tell?
I mean, I think that's the idea. I mean, I feel like Diablo and I are kind of writing this diary together and it, you know, with installments every 5 years. And this latest one is Tully, and it seems to reflect where we are right now.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Jason Reitman, for joining us today on Radio
Times.
It's
an honor to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, Tully opens in the Philadelphia area, probably across the country as well, this Friday. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Also, to download a podcast of this or any of our other shows, go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, Debbie Bilder and John Ahrens produced the show with assistance from Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.